Ed, I see that I am now on camera. Let me start off by saying that 1978 is the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the first course in public speaking at the University of Wisconsin. It was established in 1878 by Professor David Bauer Frankenberger.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, became our first chairman. He was a chairman from 78, that particular point, down to 96, I think it was. And at that point, the Department of Public Speaking was merged with the English Department until 1906. That's the year in which David Bauer Frankenberger died. And a new chairman was then brought in. His name was Rollo Lyman. He became the chairman from 1906 to 1913, and the department was made a separate department at that point. Then there was Professor O'Neill, 1913 to 1927, and then Professor Andrew Thomas Weaver from 27 to 54, myself from 54 to 70, you until 75, and now Ordean until 78. So we've had, on the whole, a relative longevity in the chairmanship, and you have the honor of having held the chairmanship the shortest period of time.
Really? Shorter even than Lyman?
Yes, Lyman was 06 to 13, that's 7 years,
mm-hmm.
and your tenure was 5.
Well, it's an honor I hope to retain, Fred. the centennial of the department, like the anniversary of almost anything one can think of, suggests history. And I'm confident that if and when the history of this department is written, the period of your administration would be particularly cited for remarkable change in the department's quality and an enhancement of its standing in the country. not to denigrate our predecessors, but I think that's the truth. The department really came into its own, at least in scholarly circles, under your administration. And it brings me to inquire, what do you attribute that to? Were there opportunities presented that weren't available to your predecessors? And after we've reviewed that, I want to inquire into some more substantive notions of yours. But I was curious about the matter of opportunity and whether they were unusual at any time in your administration.
I'm sure that in the course of events from 1954 to 1970, we probably had more opportunity for various kinds of advances than perhaps were afforded those administrators and those members of the department who were here under those administrators before that time. Now, perhaps I can suggest, however, some historical perspective here. I did mention that the department began 100 years ago. Now, when it began, it was a department which taught public speaking only. And then under David Bauer Frankenberger, there was added to the department work in theater. And that began with some actual acted drama in the late 1880s, but began with some coursework, actually, about 1890. So next to public speaking, the next field that joined the department actually was theater and drama. And this was pushed along and given a good deal of emphasis and advancement by Gertrude Johnson, who came here in 1910. And she developed courses in dramatic literature, and especially in dramatic reading. But she was also instrumental in putting together some of the theatrical societies. There was Twelfth Night, there was Edwin Booth, there were two other organizations. She put those four organizations together in 1922 and called them the Wisconsin Players. And our present University Theater is simply a new name for what we previously had called the University Players, the Wisconsin Players. Well, that showed a good deal of development there up until about, as I said, 1910. Then, with the coming of the chairman in 1913, there was a good deal of action in the whole field of public address. O'Neill was a very strong supporter of the conception of speech as such, speech, the actual production of speech. And he thought, therefore, of this department as having, among other things, a vested interest in not only public address, and not in just theater, but also in correct speech, that is to say, speech without clutter, what we now call communicative disorders. And under him, in 1915, there was established here, under Dr. Smiley Blanton, a Cornellian, by the way, mm-hmm. Who...
Wasn't he a psychiatrist?
He was. Yes, he was a medical man and a psychiatrist mm-hmm. who practiced in New York City. But he was very much interested in speech disorders. He came here as a guest professor in about 1914, and he established in 1915 what is, I am told, the first clinic in speech correction, or what we now call communicative disorders, in the United States. This was 1915. He later on went to University of Minnesota, and from Minnesota he went back to New York. And as a matter of fact, I think he died only quite recently. He was mm-hmm. a very old man when he died. The first PhD in the field of speech was offered in 1922. Now, I'm talking about the United States now. The person who received that degree was a woman, Sarah Stinchfield Hawk, and she received it in what we would call communicative disorders. Not anything like so scientific then, of course, as it is now. But this represented some new offshoot, some new developments, so that in effect, by the time the department changed its name in 1920, to the Department of Speech, it really included communication and public address, included communicative disorders, and included theater and drama. It wasn't until the 1930s that we developed work in radio, and then in the 1950s, work in television, and in the 60s, work in film. So that we then added this fourth division to our department, if we want to call it division, radio, television, film. Well, in those periods, in that period, there obviously was a good deal of advancement. Now, the department began to achieve some fame in the 20s, and this fame centered on four people. First of all, James Milton O'Neill, the chairman, who was a national figure. He was instrumental, among others, 17 altogether, 16 others in addition to himself, in establishing the National Association of Teachers of Speech in 1915. He was the first editor of the Quarterly Journal of Speech, then called the, Journal of Public Speaking, as I recall. He surrounded himself with some able people. Among them was Robert West. And Robert West was the first real professor of communicative disorders, following Smiley Blanton, who was never a permanent member of the faculty. But then there was also Henry Eubank, who got his degree here, and who was really in charge of communication and public address, and who, in the course of an illustrious career, turned out more PhDs than I think any other person in the United States, with the exception of A. Craig Baird at the University of Iowa. And it's a very close race indeed between the two of them. And the another member of that group was, of course, Andrew Thomas Weaver. Andrew Thomas Weaver joined the staff in 1917, although he was then a graduate student. He didn't join the staff actually until a little bit later than that. after he received his PhD, and he received his PhD in psychology, and so he added some psychological studies to the department and some experimental studies to the department. If we were to find or look for the scientific beginnings of our research work in speech as such, it would probably be traceable to Andrew Thomas Weaver. He himself did his dissertation on in voice science, not communicative disorders, but rather voice science itself. He never actually went on to plumb the experimental depths of the subjects that he had started with, and that was too bad. That was really quite unfortunate. But he was a very strong teacher in psychology. He was a very good student in psychology, but he was not a contributing researcher to the field of psychology. As I said, that's very unfortunate. He did, however, do what James A. Winans from Cornell also had begun, which was to levy upon the field of psychology, bringing it into a discussion of public address. He was more scientific than Winans, and his textbook on speech forms and principles, which he published in 1940 and 41, was an absolute model of that effort. It was a model textbook, and I think one of the greatest textbooks of our century in our field, along with, of course, Winans' book of 1917. Those were up to about 1954, at least, when I became the chairman, some of the major advances. I should have mentioned, incidentally, in addition to Weaver and O'Neill and Eubank, Gladys Borchers, Gladys Louise Borchers, who got a degree from this department, and who was a very strong teacher, and who was particularly interested in the pedagogy of speech, in the teaching of speech, and was, without any question, the leader in that field in the United States. And as a matter of fact, these people, these four people, became top leaders in the country. Then there was a period of time from roughly the mid-30s, despite the development of radio work, until 1955, when not very much happened, not very much changed. And then things changed with some rapidity after that. And you mentioned that the department did develop in that period of time and wondered about the opportunities that had been made available to us. Well, they were really great. We really had tremendous opportunities then. First of all, in the 1950s came television. In our institution here, in Extension Division, WHA-TV went on the air in 1954. Now, we began the teaching of television just a year or so before that, but with the actual broadcasting operation from the old university heating plant, and then we went over to the chemical engineering plant, now the site of Helen C. White Hall, television began to develop very rapidly. And John Dietrich became the head of the work in television. And there he developed an opportunity which I am really sorry to say did not flower the way I think it should have. And that was the relationship between theater and television. It's a profound relationship and one which we could have developed a lot more in our department, but didn't. But he was a theater man, a very good theater man, a practicing theater man, rather than a theorist or a philosopher. And he perceived immediately the relationship between theater and TV, and he went on to exploit it. We could have exploited that a lot more. And even right now today, we could have exploited that a lot more. Now, it wasn't for trying, incidentally. We did try, but for one reason or another, it didn't happen. However, in the 1960s, we had far more financial resources than we had ever had, I'm sure, prior to that time. And among other things, we were able to hire a lot more people than we had had. Now, to be sure, we had to prove to the administration that we deserved the opportunity to hire additional people. And we proved this, I think, in at least two ways, and maybe you can think of others as well. The first of these is that we developed a very strong liberal arts curriculum, a curriculum that went beyond, I would say, the mere teaching of skill courses, and I do not want to denigrate skill courses. This is one of our stocks in trade, and we want to keep it that way. But we developed, in addition to that, broadly based liberal arts courses, historical courses, the history of public speaking, the history of rhetorical theater, the history of film, history of radio, television, the sociological impact of some of these things, as, for example, the impact of radio, television, and film on society, and the like. These were very important courses, and a beginning course in the basic fundamental operations of human communication. Very important course, our 160 course. That's the first thing. Along with that, and the development of these courses, came then a bigger enrollment. And we began to expand far beyond the expansion that one would have expected simply because the enrollment of the university itself expanded. Our expansion was something in the neighborhood of between three and four times, whereas the collegiate enrollment expanded about double. So our experience was something like 1.5 to 2 times the actual growth experienced by the student body itself.
And do you attribute that to the substantive curriculum?
I certainly do. I attribute that almost solely to the I'm talking about the additional now.
Yes.
Now, our development of, for example, 101, you would expect it would develop simply arithmetically. But we didn't develop arithmetically. We went almost geometrically. And we did so because of these new liberal arts courses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What I'm interested in isolating, if we can, really are those characteristics of the department in the 50s and 60s that were distinctive. It's true that, for instance, the department had available to it in the late 50s unusual infusion of money. Sputnik increased expenditures to higher education, but so did everybody else. And it just seemed to me that you did more with it than some other people. It was spent better somehow.
Well,
in the then speech department, then other speech departments, some other speech departments, perhaps most, were spending it, and maybe even better than other departments in general. Now, this change in the nature of the curriculum seems like it would be an important factor to note.
It is, and then I think, in addition, obviously, you don't change the curriculum without having a staff that's going to provide the ideas for this and actually go out and do it and be successful in doing it. We've had some remarkably fine lecturers in this department, and they themselves made such a reputation in the university as a whole that students literally just flocked to us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in some senses, I suppose, we were lucky. In other senses, I think it can be said that we had a staff which understood where we ought to go and made the effort to go there. Now, for example, we developed conceptions of research which the department had not had previously. And we became a very strong research group. Now, what we did was to look for faculty members who had brains. It is true that there's more that goes into a faculty member, I presume, than simply and only brains, but number one has to be brains. And the other thing is that you've got to retain faculty members. You get them, first of all, because they have brains, and then secondly, you keep them because they put the brains to use. Now, I think that our department developed during those years a reputation for tough-mindedness. We were not going to keep on the staff and provide tenure for people who were not going to be producing scholars. Let me just give you an example of the sort of thing that was, I think, perhaps true not just of this department, but of many departments prior to this time, and which thereafter we refused to tolerate. We had an assistant professor at one time, a rather attractive young man. He was quite an attractive man. He did a good job in his classes, too. He was a good teacher. But we decided we were unable to promote him. He came into my office and asked me why it was that he wasn't being promoted. And as gently as I could, I explained to him what some of the difficulties were, including the fact that he had not written one single solitary thing in 6 years. Not one thing. And his reply to me was, "Why should I publish when I have nothing to say?" Now, he said that the first time, and I was, of course, appalled to hear it. I didn't say anything directly. I tried to pass it by. But he said it a second time. And at that point, I felt that I had to answer it. And I said to him, "Do you think that any bright graduate student or potential graduate student graduating from some other university would ever think of coming to the University of Wisconsin to study communication with us if he were convinced that we had a faculty made up of a dozen people, no one with anything to say?" Well, I used sometimes to say that one got on our staff by winning a beauty contest and stayed on the staff for permanent tenure by winning a popularity contest. That, of course, is in my more cynical moments. Mm-hmm. Actually, the department was a department, and is now, even more so than it was in the 1950s and 60s.
Yes, we've hired some ugly people and and retained some unpopular ones, I think.
Anyway, those... something else happened, and that was that we became far more research conscious than we'd ever been before. I suppose in part this was true because we had more opportunities than we'd had before. As I mentioned to you, we went out to get the bright guy, the bright woman, whoever was really smart. And one of the things which I did, and I don't like to suggest that I was alone in this at all, but one of the things that I did when I was chairman was to try to keep track of the really bright graduate students in the United States. I literally knew who were the bright students now in their second year, third year, and fourth year in the important institutions. And I kept in touch with them, I suppose a little bit in the way the recruiters for the basketball and football team now stay in touch with juniors in high school. Mm-hmm. In any case, I knew who they were. And I met them at conventions, I wrote to them, and told them to keep us in mind when they were looking for a job. Then it became necessary to compete against other institutions for these bright people. We had an advantage over most other institutions because we have the graduate school here with a good deal of research money. And so we really developed a system of providing either a summer of guaranteed research time for a new assistant professor, or, as was true then but not true now, guarantee him an actual full semester of research time if he would join our staff. Well, it was very difficult for anybody to compete with this. We outcompeted almost everybody. Mm-hmm. Even though we might offer them a slightly less salary, we didn't compete too well in terms of salary, really.
And this was at a time when there was a scarcity, wasn't there, of newly minted PhDs and lots of universities recruiting.
This was a time of real scarcity of a PhD. And it is true, as it is true of any time, it is a time of scarcity of real, honest to God, brains.
Always.
Always. And it was a time when somebody was always deciding that now he could really shoot the works and spend a lot of money to get somebody,
mm-hmm.
because enrollments were going up.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, we had to hold on to our staff in the first instance, and then in the second instance, we had to find enough money to be able to compete. As I say, I don't think we ever really truly outcompeted anybody when it comes to a salary. We never did. But we did have the research opportunities, and we played them to the hilt. And the research opportunities won because we were after the guys who wanted to do research. If somebody turned us down, we were always glad he did, because it proved that he was not the guy we wanted in the long run, and he knew it better than we did.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, people people often know their own conditions
mm-hmm.
Better than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I agree with you. You can't always... It's a bad idea to second-guess decisions mm-hmm. to not to accept mm-hmm. a job.
Mm-hmm.
Better not to second-guess. Well, you you say going for brains. But I know that under our system, you as chairman couldn't make an appointment by yourself. You had a departmental executive committee to persuade. Did you have, early in your chairmanship, any difficulties with the implementation of this kind of policy, going for brains, going for people who would execute interesting research? Did you have any problems selling that to the department as a policy?
Well, there may have been some difficulties. There may have been some reluctance. I think there was some. I don't think that there was too much, however. Not so serious that it couldn't be overcome. Now, it was overcome mostly through persistence. And it was overcome, again, through the presentation of candidates with whom it was desperately hard to argue that they shouldn't be in a university setting, and this setting in particular.
Persistence is important, isn't it?
But persistence
in university life.
Well, it is the indispensable quality for anybody who's going to be a chairman in this institution.
Yes. Yes.
As you have found out.
Yes.
You
sometimes,
just simply...
given our elaborate committee system here, I sometimes think that really it isn't brains so much as kidneys that triumph in the end. That's where the strength mm-hmm. is required.
Well, time and time again, you have to make the same arguments to the dean.
Yes.
You just have to do it almost every Monday morning, or mm-hmm. sometimes on the hour. I suppose the other thing that a chairman of this department does, and it's one of the virtues of longevity in the department, one of the virtues is that the chairman learns the ins and outs of the department.
Mm-hmm.
This department was probably the most complicated, or indeed one of the most complicated, at least, on this campus.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps a little less complicated now, since Theater and Drama have left, and since communicative disorders have their own department. Still, it's a complicated department. In those days, it was far more complicated.
Mm-hmm. A kind of federation of four departments,
yes,
wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
And that meant you really, well, you had a large staff in the first instance. They were always interested in different things in the second instance. They had different kinds of space needs, different kinds of instructional needs, different kinds of equipment needs, and that sort of thing. And this meant that what happened was that administrator became almost a full-time administrator. And by that I mean, picking up on our word persistence here, he not only was an administrator from 8 to 5, but whenever he went out and met a dean or a president or the like, he always had on tap the need for a particular piece of equipment or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter where you were, you were making a point about some of your needs. As a matter of fact, I can remember meeting the then President Fred Harvey Harrington down in Washington, D.C. at the Arena Theater one night. I was down there by myself. I went to the theater early. I was sitting in the lobby reading a book when the president came over. And so we had about a half hour, which I was able to tell him why we needed two additional faculty members.
Did it help?
Yes, it did. It always helped with Fred Harvey. He never forgot a thing.
Yes, I once, quite by accident, was able to get some 30-something thousand in equipment at lunch one day, unexpectedly, the bar on State Street, ran into an assistant dean, and he just happened to be flush that day. Yeah. Yeah, you have to know, don't you, what you want.
You have to know,
administer.
It has to be, yes, that's right.
Well, getting back to the tremendous change in the quality of the department that occurred, I think, in the late 50s, early 60s, or during the decade of the 60s. You said you always looked for brains, and you had to bring around a department executive committee. Persuasion is an important adjunct to the chair, isn't it? You've got to be able to persuade your colleagues. In fact, isn't that just about the only source of authority?
It is indeed the only source of authority one has in this kind of a very democratic system. And I applaud the system and support the system. It obviously provides us with some cumbersomeness, but as any democratic system does, but in the long run, it's the only one under which I would want to operate. The advantage, though, that a chairman has is enormous. For he knows what the facts are, and nobody else really does. He has a total picture of the whole department, and who needs this, who's doing what, and so on. He also has a better conception of what's going on in the whole college because obviously the dean tells him and he meets with other chairmen and so on. As a consequence of this, he's bound to be in a position of having the facts. Now, if he can put those facts together in some kind of a coherent fashion, as presumably he ought to be capable of doing, then the persuasion is almost made to order.
Mm-hmm.
Our faculty members, I think, were always willing. Given the facts and an understanding of them, we had strong support. I had very strong support while I was chairman, and almost no difficulties. Our difficulties came as you can undoubtedly surmise and from your own experience, when you would try to do something with whatever resources you had for one group in the department, and the other group had to be left out for a while, at least, let us say for a year or whatever. And so this is always difficult. Everybody wants to progress, everybody wants to achieve something, and so here you are not coming up with the money, the supplies, the equipment, the personnel, the courses, etc., that somebody wants. But we did, over a long period of time, by that I mean 3 years, we would get something for almost everybody.
Mm-hmm. Even it out over time.
Yeah, even it out over time.
Yeah, there's
a
kind of leapfrog quality to the to it all, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're getting a signal to
stop.
Okay.
Fred, one of the kinds of decisions that I know you had to make when you were chairing had to do with the disposition of this infusion of money the department was getting for capital expenditures.
Okay. Cut. Stop. Are you ready now?
Fred, I know that one of the decisions you had to make during the period you were chairman was how to spend some of the money you were getting for capital acquisitions, equipment, supplies, the like of that, facilities even. And though, again, I think here, too, we, we had a situation in the late 50s, early 60s, where lots of universities were getting substantial amounts of money for this. Some spent it well and some badly, and it seemed to me, in retrospect, this department spent it pretty well. Could I invite you to address yourself to that matter, review that?
Well, I'm not so sure that we had a lot of money, Ed.
Really?
No, not a lot. We had some money. We had to scratch something fierce to get the money, really. We didn't really get very much money until we got this building, which was 1972. That is to say, sometime between 1968 and 72, that four-year span of time while the building was going up. And at that point, we got a lot of money indeed. I'll say something about that in just a moment. But let's talk, first of all, about some of these facilities which we developed between roughly 1950 and 1970. Some of them didn't take very much money, but were really ideas. Then the ideas, because they caught on, were really funded, and we did get money. But we didn't have money to begin with. We got the money because we succeeded in doing some things. The very first thing, the very first facility with which I had any connection was the establishment of the Wisconsin Center for the History of Communication Research, the Mass Communications History Center, the Mass Communications History Center. And that came about in this way. This was before I was chairman. There was a piece in the State Journal about the State Historical Society of Wisconsin being given the collection that had been put together by Hans Kaltenborn, premier radio commentator. And the next day after reading that, I spoke to Henry Eubank and suggested that maybe what we ought to do would be to go to all the other pioneers on the radio and see if we couldn't get their papers and put them somewhere, I assumed our library. Henry thought that was a great idea, and he immediately called a man named Lord, who was then a director of the State Historical Society, now the president of Hofstra, by the way. We had lunch that same day down at the University Club, and Mr. Lord was a promoter from way back. He thought it was a great idea. And he's the one who invented the name, the Mass Communications History Center. And he was off and running. The next director that came in after Lord left was Leslie...
Fischel?
Fischel. Mm-hmm. Les Fischel. And Les Fischel was very anxious to establish a name for himself. And he wondered what new territory could he develop. And it turned out to be the Mass Communications History Center. So consequently, he put a lot of resources into it, and so did our graduate school, so that we were able to put money into travel and so on. Then we developed an offshoot of the Mass Communications History Center, which became the Wisconsin Center for Theater Research. And that came about in part because we wanted to try to save for the department a young man that we thought had a lot of promise. And what happened was this. We really developed this as a place to put him and see if he couldn't make a go of it and be on this department. This was a young man who was one of those people with brains. Unfortunately, and this is very frequently true, you have to have something besides brains in order to survive. And he couldn't teach. And the consequence was that he would have a class, and there would be, let us say, 20 students originally in the class. The second day the class would meet, there would be only 10, and the third time there would be 5, and so on. So this became very difficult. In addition to this, he was a very difficult man. He was one of these almost all-or-nothing people. Anytime he had an idea, it had to be developed absolutely to its logical conclusion, and that all subjects rightly pursued branch out into infinity, as our friend Edmund Burke said, and he sure enough tried to do it. In any case, we thought the thing to do was to get him out of the classroom and perhaps put him somewhere else. And so we got the idea of setting up separately the Wisconsin Center for Theater Research, put him in charge of it. Well, he did a fine job. in many ways. The trouble was that he was not a very tactful man, and as a consequence, he was constantly getting into difficulties with Les Fischel. So almost every day, I had to smooth over some kind of a crisis until ultimately it became just downright impossible, and so he had to leave. Well, we got another man in then as the head of that Center for Theater Research. He was worse. And he had to leave after a year and a half. There was just no way that he could get along with anybody. Then we brought in a young man from Iowa, and he was splendid. But he was offered the headship of the theater group down at Iowa, his own alma mater, and he decided to take it. I thought it was a mistake, by the way, and it turned out ultimately that it was a mistake. He went there, eventually went somewhere else. Then we brought in Tino Baglio. And Tino Baglio has been a genius at running the Theater Research Center and is now called the Center for Theater and Film Research, and has been developed under Tino and by Tino, not only as a theater research center, but also as a film research center. And I suppose for the record, we ought to mention that he has developed relationships with United Artists and has brought in the films from given to us by United Artists, the films produced by Warner Brothers, films produced by RKO, as well as many others. So that we have something in the neighborhood of a film collection valued at something like $18 million. A tremendous collection. Well, that was one of the things that we developed. And as I say, it didn't take very much money to start off with. In fact, practically nothing. It did take money, however, to proceed. And now we're getting a great deal of money and support from the graduate school, from Letters and Science and the like, for the Theater Research Center. Another one of the centers that we developed was a communications research center. This took some doing, by the way. It took a lot of doing because there was some departmental jealousies within the university about our setting up something that we would call the Communication Research Center. But we were able to overcome that difficulty, and we did. We were permitted to rent a property down on University Avenue, now, of course, demolished, and set up there a young man named Ted Clevenger as the head of the Theater Research, the head of the Communication Research Center. He was a very bright young man and an extraordinary worker and a challenging teacher. And he got a number of graduate students here who are all interested in communication research, experimental research, statistical, scientific research. And they did a good job. He left to go to the University of Pittsburgh and various other places, and ultimately became, and is now, a dean down at Florida State University. In his place, we brought in Fred Williams, and he was another just superb man, an excellent researcher, excellent teacher, and developed a number of fine students. And every year, we would turn out PhDs who would be better than the PhDs we turned out the year before. Every year, the new PhD would be the best we'd ever turned out. And this was because we were getting much more sophisticated and getting a bigger staff as well. He left and is now the dean of the School of Annenberg. It's called
Annenberg School of Communication.
Annenberg School of Communication at USC. A fine job, and he's doing an excellent piece of work there. And then came Tom Scheidel. And Tom Scheidel was a man of stature when he arrived. The other two weren't. They really made their reputations here. He had a reputation before he came here, having come here from Illinois. And a really splendid teacher, a splendid colleague, fine researcher, among other things, the editor of the Speech Monographs, one of our research journals. And he's now the chairman out at the University of Washington. So all of our people went on to big things. And we now have in charge a young man named Joe Capella. And Joe is undoubtedly the most scientific, the best prepared mathematically and statistically in the lore of experimentation of anybody we've ever had. And as a consequence of this, is doing a great job for us. Everybody is, of course, improving over what we had all done 15 and 20 years ago. And we are, at this point, much more sophisticated than we've ever been. And now in this new building, we have All of our people went on to big things. And we now have in charge a young man named Joe Capella. And Joe is undoubtedly the most scientific, the best prepared mathematically and statistically in the lore of experimentation of anybody we've ever had. And as a consequence of this, is doing a great job for us. Everybody is, of course, improving over what we had all done 15 and 20 years ago. And we are, at this point, much more sophisticated than we've ever been. And now in this new building, we have a suite of three rooms for experimental research, including a PDP-12 with all its ancillary equipment. The equipment itself, that research equipment, is worth something in the neighborhood of $70,000. And in addition to that, we have all kinds of wiring wired up to rooms all over the place, so they can do a tremendous amount of research. Those two are probably the most important adjuncts. The Mass Communications History Center is something that we ought to develop, by the way. And somebody ought to do some collecting of speeches for that center. For example, we have, at the present time, in the United States, there is not available, on film or videotape, John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech of 1960. Nor is there available, on film or videotape, the whole speech done by Martin Luther King in 1963 in the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech. It doesn't exist. And they don't exist in part because when these two men were assassinated, the networks immediately rushed to get the biography on the air that particular night, that same night. And as a consequence, they simply tore up all the stuff they had, swept out what they didn't use, and put on what they wanted to preserve. And so we still have the videotape and a film version of the last part of the I Have a Dream speech, but not the other. In other words, all I'm saying is that we ought to have the same kind of archival materials for public address that we now have for film and for theater, and which we're developing in other places as well. I suppose, though, that in the long run, the main thing that we ever did was to get our building, Wireless Communication Hall.
Yes, I did want to ask you about that, because I came here in 67. The building was not built yet, but the appropriations battle was, I guess, in its final stages in 67. Thing wasn't decided by any means. And my memory of those 3 years from 67 to 70 is that you were really very preoccupied with the problems attendant on getting this building built. It seemed at the time, it seemed like a Perils of Pauline operation. Why was the appropriation so precarious? Why was it so hard fought?
It was indeed a Perils of Pauline. You're absolutely right on that. And it was hard fought. And we were in grave difficulties of losing the whole appropriation. There were several reasons for that. The first one is that we were given the appropriation, the first one, in 1963-65.
Is this for planning?
This was for planning money. And we also had $1 million, by the way, which is more than planning money.
Oh, yeah.
But that $1 million was given to somebody else. I mean, it was put into the biennial budget and was actually appropriated, but the university was permitted later on to use it for something else, so we never did have that $1 million. Let me back up just a moment and say that we began the effort to get a building in 1957. And I made the first request for a building for what was then the speech department in 1957. And I was told to put it in writing.
I should mention, when I came here in 67, the department was in, I think, 6 different buildings.
We taught speech in 17.
17.
We taught speech in 17.
We had offices in 6.
That's right. We had offices in 6 buildings.
It was impossible.
It was just totally impossible to administer.
It was. Well, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Totally impossible. So I was asked to make a report and put it in writing, which I did for the first time in 1958. And then again in 1959, and indeed every year after that, we continued to go out of edge. We recurred to our word persistence.
Yes.
And we put in a report every year. Every time it was double the size of what it had been the year before. Then in 1959, we made common cause with WHA, WHA-TV, and with the School of Journalism. And so the three of us put in a request. Now, this request was much more ambitious than what we got out, but nonetheless, we put in a request. And in 1961, 63, we were put on the biennial list. We were number 41. Well, of course, we had no chance for funding and didn't get any funding. We went up in the list for 1963-65, because that was the era in which we did build tremendously at the university, and consequently, we got a lot of money from the state legislature during those years, and projects could move on and off the list. Well, we got a little higher. We were given $1 million, but as I mentioned to you, the $1 million was diverted somewhere else. In 1965-67, we were given our basic appropriation. That was $7.5 million. Now, what happened then was, in effect, two things. First of all, we thought we were going to have the site on which Helen C. White Hall is built, but we were asked to take this site, which we were glad to accede to after a bit of a battle, but we did agree to accede to this site. However, there were 33 parcels held by private business on this site, and it took a long time to resolve the question of ownership and getting all this property by the university. In fact, it took us over 3 years. As a consequence, we suffered a great deal of attrition of our money through inflation. So much so that we went to the legislature at one point when we thought we were going to be able to dig in 1968 and ask for an additional $800,000, that having been the sum that we figured had been eroded. The legislature gave us the $800,000. By the time we were able to build, however, we had suffered another $400,000 of inflation. And at this point, it was decided that it was just impossible to go to the state legislature to ask for any more money, and we did not do so. Rather, what we did do was to cut out $400,000 from the building, what we assumed would be about $400,000 from the building. Well, that was one problem. We had the problem of getting the site, a legal problem. We then had the problem of trying to pay for a building, which was much more ambitious than what our money was because we had suffered so much inflation. Then, in 1969, in the spring of 1969, President Richard Nixon asked that there be a halt to federal and state construction. And this, of course, naturally affected us. Now, he said in his directive that he did not expect a state to halt construction on plans that had been far advanced. But nonetheless, what was the meaning of far advanced? One of the legislators thought that surely it meant that we were not far advanced, and he introduced a bill in the legislature to retract our appropriation. Now, this is the spring of 69, and we're figuring on going to digging in roughly the fall, we hoped in the fall. So this bill actually came up for discussion and for public hearing. I appeared before the public hearing and answered the objections that had been made by this legislator. Well, before the bill was sent to the legislature itself, and we think that it wouldn't have passed there, it went to the building committee, that is to say the State Building Commission. Now, the State Building Commission is composed of 8 votes. We had to get 5. You have to get a majority. 4 loses.
Mm-hmm.
When the vote was taken, the vote stood at 4-3 with the first 7 polled votes. And clearly then, it was up to that 8th man. And depending on that vote, well, it was with great reluctance that he voted. And he voted yes, making 5 votes. He voted so softly that the secretary had to ask him what his vote was. It was yes, and we won by 1 vote. The next day, we had a steam shovel on the 800 block, and we started digging the very next day. Well, as you can see, there were very direct, well, I should mention, however, there was one other difficulty, and that is that when we went out for bids, when the bids came back, we were $1,187,000 over our appropriation. And it was predicted by the administration that we had just no possibility whatsoever of obtaining that money. Now, previously, we had suggested, and I had really pushed the idea of going to the Vilas trustees to ask for money to build a theater. Now, that theater, the big theater, had been excised from the building plans because we had no money to build it. I had twice asked for this, and both times had been turned down on the grounds that it was just simply impossible. The Vilas trustees would not provide us with this money. When we came in $1,187,000 over, we had a meeting, and it was a lugubrious affair, let me tell you. And just as a kind of parting remark, not thinking that it would have any effect whatsoever, I said, "Do you think there's any possibility that we could get money from the Vilas trustees?" And President Harrington and Vice President Clodius thought about this. They didn't say anything at the time, but the next day they went out to go to work on this, and they went to the trustees, and the trustees did give the money, $1,187,000, to us, and we were able to go ahead with the building. And so a grateful constituency named the building the Vilas Communication Hall. Well, this building, the actual construction was $10,750,000, and there is in the building, counting WHA and WHA, with money not only from the state but also from the federal government for equipment, we have a total of approximately $4 million worth of equipment in the whole building, making a total of something in the neighborhood of $15 million. Now, this equipment has been equipment for communication and public address. It's been equipment for radio, television, film. We have beautiful facilities for radio and for television. Our facilities for film are not what they ought to be. This because at the time that we made our plans, and you understand, the plans that we were stuck with were plans which we made in 1963. We couldn't change those plans. Mm-hmm. And that's an extremely bad, really kind of a bad situation that the state gets itself into. Here we didn't dig a hole until 1969, and we are stuck with plans which we did in 1963. Well, between 1963 and 1969, we began to develop our work in film quite a lot. We've developed it much more since, and so consequently, we are not what we ought to be in that field. But we've done very well in this department, in this building, and quite plainly, to go back to a question which you asked before, the department's premier position, and I think we can say that it has a premier position in communication departments in the United States, is dependent upon, first of all, our faculty, of course, and upon our curriculum, but also upon our facilities. Quite plainly, we have the best facilities without any doubt of any department in the country.
Well, all of this took a lot of doing and consumed your time. Would you do it again?
I've thought about that a lot of times, and I'm almost of the opinion that I would not. I was probably chairman really too long.
You'd get out soon, as I did.
Yes, as a matter of fact, you know, of course, that I urged you to stay on.
Yes.
And I was sorry to see you leave the chairmanship. I wanted you to stay. You were really doing a splendid job for the department. You were representing the department extraordinarily well. Nobody ever represented it better.
Well,
and I was dismayed when you decided to leave. I guess I am totally convinced of what I said earlier, namely that this department requires somebody to be in that chair who knows the circumstances and who has the support of the faculty and can get the support of the administration, because in the long run, That's how we succeed, I think. So I just don't think there's any doubt that from the point of view of the general development of the department, it was probably useful for me to be in the chairmanship that long. From my own personal point of view, it was not. There's just no doubt about that in my mind. As you know, I did quit in 1970, this because it became obvious that either I write that book on the Nobel thing, or I give it up, one or the other. It was impossible to do both. And so I decided at that point that I had to do this, and so I did. Now, since then, I spent 2 more years. The problem with being an administrator, and especially at the University of Wisconsin, is that you don't really participate in some of the great benefits of this institution if you're an administrator on the lower level, so to speak. It means, among other things, that you can't conceivably be a top-flight teacher because you don't have the time for that. And it's impossible, therefore, to stay up with your field. It's also impossible to be a first-class research man. You just can't do it. And again, as a consequence of all this, you don't participate in the research grants that the university has at its disposal. You don't get the leave of absence that other people get. In short, you're constantly working for somebody else and not for yourself, which in many ways, I suppose, is all right. But in the long run, your professional career suffers. If I had to do again, I think that I would spend more time on research. I'd try to produce at least one other book. I would certainly try to develop another course. I've had a good deal of fun in the last 8 years, particularly, developing the Great Speakers and Great Speeches course, a course which is offered in the multimedia laboratory, and I've developed a slide and audio tape presentations that are really, I think, very interesting and to me very challenging. I think I would try to do another course that would be somewhat along the same lines, perhaps a contemporary course. So I'm sorry to see time run out on me, so to speak, and not have the opportunity to write a little more and to teach a little more. In the long run, that's what professoring is all about.